I'll make some announcements while I do. We have the exam completely graded. We were not able to hand it back to you because one of your unfortunate classmates is not going to take it due to some medical concerns. Looks like that person will take it on Wednesday. I'll be able to bring it to you in class on Wednesday so you'll have it. The short answer is you guys did as a class well, which is very good news because my other class did as a class poorly. And it's better to be in the class that did well. By well, I mean many, many A's and many B's. Not all people got A's or B's, but I think as a class, you guys understand, at least to me, that the broad issues I really wanted you to know about, you know, what are the gene, what are these things doing, how they're working together, based on the assessment that we gave you, you guys got that part. So I'm very pleased with that. We are going to have our second assignment coming up in the next week or so. 2 weeks after you get your gene name in the email, you're going to need to turn in your gene hunt assignment. I think there are clear enough instructions on the syllabus, but we'll probably have Tracy copy them and paste them again. Make sure that everyone knows, and if you've got specific questions, you know, by all means, seek clarification. This is not meant to be some killer assignment. It's going to end up being really tricky. We're going to ask you less, you know, minute details. It's meant to be an exercise to demonstrate to you how the internet empowers you as new molecular biologists to put the information we've talked about in terms of a handful of genes in a larger context, in fact, in the context of all 35,000 genes or however many there's going to be in the end. Today we're going to do, today and on Wednesday, our last lecture is really on genes, and we're going to really get into full bore now neurons. It may have been obvious, it may not have been, that everything we've been studying up until now has to do with neurons, but it also has to do with every other type of cell in the body. We're going to get into a few issues that are more specialized, more specific to neurons, and in fact some types of properties that are quite unusual that neurons do that other areas don't. But there are not going to be any major new surprises. The broad issues of how things get laid out have already been established. You guys, I think, have a pretty good understanding now of what genes are and how they work. So we'll go through a few other examples from non-neural tissue to cement our understanding of what we mean by a cell being of a specific cell type, and then move forward into neurons in particular. The neurotrophic hypothesis and this issue of neural death, cell death. Any questions about the exam, or we are going to pass it back? We will have your grades entered by the end of today, probably. So you'll be able to see them on that Orion thing. I think you guys can see the midterm grades if you want to. Any other questions? PowerPoint 2007 loading. The issues we're going to talk about today involve the different genes that individual cell types turn on. And the reason that they turn on a given gene is one of two possible reasons. One reason to activate a gene is so that you can generate some function that's specific to the cell type that you need to be. So for neurons, you can think of large numbers of different genes you'd need to do normal neural function. If you're going to want to send action potentials, you got to turn on the voltage-gated sodium channels and so forth. So a large number of genes are being turned on because we actually need those machines, those enzymes, those motor proteins, those transporters and receptors and neurotransmitter synthesis enzymes and all the rest. We need those things to do this job. The rest of the genes are being turned on so that we have the right genes to do all those other jobs. And it's a little bit of a challenge to distinguish between these two things in some cases, but most of the time it's pretty clear that this is sort of an end-stage gene, or the last step in all this gene regulation, that turning on gene C. And then the other genes you know, these are regulatory genes that are contributing to getting the final thing done. So, for example, just to be clear, the homeobox genes don't actually do anything related to making antenna or feet or anything else interesting. They're simply there to cause the cell to turn on all the genes that need to be done. We talked about how one gene is more than likely not turning on one, but a whole array of different genes. There are proteins that need to be in place to generate the function of interest. In many cells, it's hard to really identify what is it that the cell is doing. So it's going to be hard to understand how do we, you know, which particular proteins do we need to be able to generate some specific function, given that, as we've discussed in Seiler, the function of a single cell can be remarkably complicated. We originally thought, oh, the brain is just the sum total of a bunch of cells, the cells themselves are simple, no big deal. We now come to understand that there are many, many different types within neurons, and more broadly spoken, many, many different types of cells generally. And so here's just another sort of reminder, not only do the cells have to do their function, but they have to have their shape, and then we've talked about these very different shapes, sizes, structures. We've talked about what the possibilities of getting this point are, if you want to have all these different flavors of cells and different colors, whether you want to make specialized groups that then go and divide and make more of the same, or unspecialized groups that later use signals to distinguish themselves. And we've gone through, I think in gory detail, a bunch of experiments to demonstrate this is not some theoretical possibility. These are easy things to see and do. You can rip out cells, move them someplace else, and suddenly all of them change their fate to something different, or all of them continue doing the same thing. We talked about a number of different model organisms that make it possible to understand this problem in better detail. And one of the ones that's my favorite, I worked on it for a number of years, is this Cynorhabditis elegans, this little tiny free-living nematode in the soils all around the world. And now it's got a finite number of cells, and they do all of the interesting things that we do. They merge cells together, and they have cells that commit suicide and die, and cells that migrate, and they make neurons and neural networks and so forth. But unlike our own brain with billions of neurons, this thing's only got 302. So in principle, it will be much, much, much easier to understand development in this species. Now, the long and the short of it is, this thing with only 1,000 cells, 302 neurons, every one of whose connections we know, we actually don't know how it develops. We've had the genome sequence much longer than the human genome, and that has an extra few years head start, has not meant that we're right around the corner on the human genome, taking the raw genetic material and suddenly going, ah, here's how everything works, right? Sometimes people speculate that we would just be like looking behind the screen and it would all just be obvious and clear once we had the genome sequence. That does not appear to be the case. We sequence a lot of genomes now, working on the platypus genome and the orangutan genome and the mammoth genome and the Neanderthal genome now. And none of the genomes we have suddenly made it easy to understand. And the reason is, it's not just what the organism is doing, but what's happening at the individual cellular level turns out to be more complicated than we thought it was going to be. So what we want to do in understanding the final steps of cell differentiation is find a bunch of cells that are really distinct, so you really know this is a different cell than this cell. Not neurons where everybody's kind of a smear. And a bunch of cells where you can really nail down what their functions are. And there aren't very many systems like this, but one of the handful of systems that is easy to study for a bunch of experimental reasons are actually the blood cells. And one of the reasons is they're round, that makes them simple because they're freely soluble in blood serum. They can actually be sorted, so you can literally take buckets of blood and go through, sort them out into individual ones, where you have almost perfect separation of individual cell types. So normally they exist all bouncing around together and interacting and signaling each other and following their cell lineage and so forth. But you can easily separate them out with these cell sorters because unlike neural tissue, which you have to rip apart to get down to the individual cell layer, these guys are individually floating around in any case. And what you see in these cells is just reminiscent of what we're going to see in neurons, what we've seen throughout the course. A series of sort of branch points where cells decide, I'm going to become this type of cell, I'm going to become this type of cell. and not some one protein that gets turned on to tell a cell, you will be this and exactly this. Now, one of the techniques that's possible once you have a tissue sample that is all made up of one cell type, which again, we thought that's no big deal, but it turns out there are very few tissues that are made up of one cell type. But now we have a sample of sorted blood cells that's all made up of one cell type. What you can do is go and ask, not just is this gene on, is this blood formation protein Y or whatever it is on, but you can ask what large numbers of genes are being turned on. So the technology has been kicked up several orders of magnitude from doing it one at a time to doing thousands at a time. And what this is a gene chip. Again, some of you have heard about it, some of you never have. The general idea is shown here and discussed in the book. We won't go through it in more detail. But the idea basically is if you purify out the mRNA from a given set of cells, in this case, homogenized sample of blood cells, you can go and find out where the complementary sequences of all of the different genes are. Literally, it's possible to check all 35,000 all at one time. And what you do is you get one of these little chips, and you embed at each point a different sequence that's held in place, and then you have special markers that allow them to glow to differing extents depending on the percentage of chains that are bound to the complementary mRNA sequence present in the sample that you created. So this is not any big deal. We've been able to do this before. We saw it in situ hybridization. Now all we're doing is instead of keeping the cells in place, we're ripping them all apart, lumping them all together, and simultaneously screening large numbers of gene expression patterns at the same time. Here's one from Affymetrix that screens 1800. And again, in the not too distant future, it'll be totally possible to dump your sample onto one chip and check all the genes that there are. Mostly they use small subsets because people are only interested in a subset of all the genes. Now this data, just by looking at it, is sort of intriguing. The color is telling you how much of each gene there is. The first thing you see is there's not two colors, it's a whole bunch of different colors. There's no scale bar up there, unfortunately, but you get the idea. I believe white is the highest amount, and red, and green, and blue, and black. The idea is genes are on all kinds of different levels. That there's genes, these genes are not ordered by any particular rhyme or reason. But you'll see there are lots and lots and lots and lots of genes that are not on. At least the mRNA of most of these genes are not present in this cell at this time. Now what does that mean? Does that mean they didn't do anything? No. It could easily have been that it was on at a very high level 20 minutes ago. It's just not on right now. It could easily have meant that that gene was critically involved in getting to this stage, but it isn't necessary to stay at this stage. So it's hard to know exactly what to interpret, but the idea of beginning to look at all the genes, this isn't all of them, but large numbers, is one to realize it's a finite problem. It's not an infinitely complicated problem. We're not going to keep throwing new genes at you. We're almost at the stage where we know every single one. And in the case of blood, at least, because it is so simple and easy to study, people have gone through, and pretty much, we're not going to memorize any of these genes, because it's not really come up again, but pretty much gone and figured out which genes are involved in each of these transformations, and figured out which genes are there multiple different outcomes, depending upon, presumably, the local cell interactions, which ones are driven by the expression pattern of cell lineage, other genes, which things are positive, and which things are positive feedback, and so forth. So we've got this great system, and we're feeling pretty good that we've got a handle, at least in one simple system, in the neurons we want. But we can easily imagine the same kind of thing. If we're looking at cells divided, questions, in the proliferative ventricular zone, and they're divided into movie neurons, movie neuron, movie neuron, that there could be a whole pattern like this, analogous to what we've seen in fly development, where different decisions, different branch points are being made, and cells are turning on different proteins, and those proteins will tell you to not be one flavor or to be another flavor. Now this leads us to the really sort of core of this last problem we have to nail down. We've touched on it a lot. And that is really at the core of it, sort of down to the philosophical deep level. What does it mean to be a blood cell? What does it mean to be a cell in layer 5 of cortex? What does it mean to be a Purkinje cell of Wilms' cells? And what we think we mean is something like this. So you turn on all those genes, that's what we see. And the problem is, many of these genes are talking to other genes and telling other genes what to do. So it may be that you don't actually have to have on all of those proteins to be this particular type of cell. Maybe it's really just, you know, this one gene here at a high level, and it's going to suddenly turn on all the other genes and have this entire pattern. So maybe the identity of a cell comes down to a single protein. You turn this on, you will be this cell. That's a totally reasonable possibility. This has come into play in a whole variety of different reasons, and one of the most complex arenas where this has come up has been, what if I don't want to be any one type of cell? What if I want to be a cell who can be any type of cell? One of the cell types we've been studying the most is the least differentiated, so-called embryonic stem cell. People are fascinated by these cells for all kinds of reasons. They are a type of cell. They express a very particular pattern of genes. It's easy to tell if you've got one. But it's hard to tell what of all that mess is critical to being an embryonic stem cell. New paper journals are coming out every week, literally in the last few weeks. I think they're down to 3 genes now that are required. You just turn these genes on, bam, the cell's an embryonic stem cell. Now, just a few years ago when I started teaching this class, the answer was only embryonic stem cells can become embryonic stem cells. There's no way to turn a normal cell into an embryonic stem cell. You have to have an embryo. They only come from embryos. That's why we call them embryonic stem cells. And some people thought, yeah, there's something really special about this cell. It's an embryo. There's a specific sort of history and fate, been in a particular context, cell lineage, cell interactions, all those things that are just right. There's no way to sort of fake it. Other people were much more wedded to the rules of physics, saying, if I make a cell in every way like something, it has to be that thing. You can't say it's impossible to make something. And the question is not, is it possible to make an embryonic stem cell, but how simple is it? Is it one gene you can turn on, just that one or that one? Or is it 4 or 5 or 10? A number of people made up the guess, it's 5. Because I figured if it's not 5, it's 55. We're in deep trouble. It's hard to find needles in a haystack, let alone 55 needles in a haystack of 35,000 proteins. It's going to take a really long time. So partly on the premise that, let's just start with the assumption it's doable, people started looking for sets of proteins that would do it. Well, before this line of most cutting-edge research, people had begun from the other end. Rather than trying to figure out how can I take a cell and magically make it into an embryo, by doing a bunch of fancy molecular biology, how can I do some simple transplantation experiment that doesn't rely upon me taking bets on individual genes and a pool of 35,000 candidates, but allows me to do simpler things and begin to probe what is possible. And the experiment that was done, it really rocked the world, all the way down to public press, I think, and you guys probably heard about these sorts of experiments, and you continue to hear about them in popular movies and articles and the like. Was this one first, and later done in some sheep and some other things, and in the not-too-distant future, doubtlessly done in humans, where someone says, what if I go and get myself a skin cell from any number of animals? Doesn't make any difference. And I suck out of it the nucleus. And I transplant that nucleus into an unfertilized oocyte that I have destroyed its nucleus. So it's a really simple idea. All we're going to do is take an oocyte, which normally has, as you may recall, one copy of all the genes, and so it's sort of half of an animal. It's kind of busted in a very important way. And then we're just going to stick in both copies of the genome of the animal this thing really belonged to. Okay. So we start with a frog oocyte, and we add to it a frog nucleus, and guess what happens? You get a frog. Now, we weren't expecting necessarily to get, you know, three-headed tarantulas or whatever else. We were kind of thinking, it makes good sense that you'd get a frog out, because you have all the parts. The only thing special about this is one very minor technical detail, is that the frog that you get out here is an identical twin of an animal who is much older. You wouldn't call that animal this animal's mother, right, because he has identical genes. It's hard to call that the twin, because one of them is a very different age. We typically think of the twins as being the same age. But the reality is, it is simply a twin. Okay? It has the same genetic structure as this one. They just happen to be different ages. And we've known about twins for thousands of years. There's nothing really miraculous about them. So what? They have the same DNA. No big deal. In biology, there's always a footnote. The footnote, of course, is this thing might have slightly different mitochondrial DNA because you've only transferred the nucleus and blah, blah, blah. But for all intents and purposes, the vast majority of genes for this animal and that animal will be the same. So the idea now is, what made this cell wasn't the nucleus. It can't be the nucleus, right? Because we've just transplanted the nucleus and suddenly the thing became an oocyte. And that's a little strange for us. Like, how could it not be the nucleus? Isn't DNA the blueprint of life? If DNA is the blueprint of life, I've disparaged this idea for a long time, but it's still in your heads as it's the blueprint. We don't have anything else. What other choices do we have? Then where are we now if DNA is just some hot swappable thing that doesn't mean anything? And the answer is, well, whatever else is left after you destroy all this DNA with ultraviolet light, that stuff must be what it is to be this cell, an embryo. It must be in here somewhere. And this kind of makes sense once you think about it, because, of course, it couldn't have been the DNA, because the DNA is the same in all the cells. Right? The DNA doesn't make any sense to be the thing that tells you which type of cell you are, because we talked about every cell has the same DNA. And so the DNA can't provide any useful information. So if it isn't the DNA, then what is it? And the obvious answer is it's the protein. There's all kinds of proteins in here. And now that we've got this understanding, which we'll see becomes quite close to true, not true, because biology never is anything simple, but it's pretty close to true, that what makes this thing an embryo, what makes it about to be a baby, is not that it happens to have this nucleus. That's sort of a minor point. It needs a nucleus, or it won't go on to make a baby. But the nucleus alone is not enough. The specific animal, genetically, that it's going to make, is going to be related to that DNA. But the identity of this thing, not as an individual, but as a cell type, has nothing to do with the DNA. It has to do with the machinery that knows how to read the DNA and what to do with the DNA. And that's all about the cytoplasm, all the goo that's here in an oocyte. So this is a really big deal. It says we know what we're looking for. The identity of an individual cell is based on what proteins it's expressing. That's the general idea. And this is not new to us. We've been talking about this for a while. You might turn on gene X, and it might make an mRNA and finally a protein. And that protein goes on to turn on lots of things and maybe turn off a few things in very much the way that I've diagrammed very roughly here. We'll try not to have Fs. So turn off that F gene. And so that really doesn't seem like such a surprising state of affairs. The problem really is that proteins come and go, and you want to maintain yourself over long periods of time. So if I were to take a cell and insert a bunch of some transcription factor, would it suddenly become that cell? Is it possible to take a cell from my skin and suddenly turn it into a baby? Is it just that easy? Or is there some missing magical component that we don't know about? Is it possible to add one or two of these factors? Or do I need to add 20 or 30 or 20 or 30,000? Where are we on the scope of possibilities? Another way to say the same question, a little bit more simply, is how does the cell, not a brain, not an organ, not a baby, just a single cell, how does it remember what its fate is? Let's assume it decided, for whatever reasons. Somebody told it, its great-grandmother decided, whatever reason this particular cell decided to become this thing, how does it not forget? And some people, this seems like anthropomorphic kind of thing. Like, that's not really a memory. A memory is something different. And I mean memories being explicit memories. This thing doesn't have consciousness, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is this concept of memory becomes very important. Lots of things have memory. I mean, memory is not magic. Because in neuroscience, we don't have a very good understanding of complex episodic memories like, you know, when you graduated high school or whatever. Because we can't tell you where that thing is exactly doesn't mean that the concept of memory is some mysterious, magical thing. It's just some state change in the system. And if you could go in and exactly duplicate in somebody's head, like in Total Recall or whatever else, that memory of that set of events, then you would have that memory. That's it. If you turn all the neurons to the state that my head is in for having that memory, then you would have it too. it isn't impossible. The same thing is happening here. We're coming to understand that to make a neuron a particular fate, including a brand new baby about to divide and make lots of more cells of the same type, and eventually an entire new human, all you have to do is give it the memory that you are a fertilized embryo. And it will go about doing its business of making fertilized embryos. Now, again, this is the stuff of science fiction. Oh my God, what would it be if you could make hundreds and thousands of, you know, clones of yourself? I've got two half clones of myself, and I assure you, raising two is enough work. You are unlikely to want to raise tens of thousands of yourselves. And the idea that you're going to be able to do a good job raising tens of thousands of yourself seems very, very unlikely. It is totally possible, however, to make lots and lots and lots of screwed up versions of yourself. But it's not clear why you would have to. So here's the general story that people have worked through. And I'll show you first the broad notion. Someone asked the biologist, how does a cell remember what it is? The answer is going to be because of its genes. That answer is not going to mean anything because the gene is a broad concept. They're going to rephrase it. It's because of the proteins it expresses. The cell knows what it is because of the proteins it expresses. And that has nothing to do with the nucleus. So when a cell divides, there's a transient moment where that cell pushes out all of the gene regulation, or almost all of the gene regulation proteins, from the nucleoplasm, from the inside of the nucleus. And the reason is, you're trying to copy all this DNA, and you can't be simultaneously having things binding and screwing up DNA replication, so you just kick all that stuff out. And at that moment, nothing in the nucleus has the foggiest idea what it's supposed to be. This is tabula rasa, it's just, I'm gonna be a frog, or I'm gonna be a human, or I'm gonna be a bird, or a dinosaur, or a space alien, whatever it's gonna be. And then some really miraculous thing happens. The little floodgates open back up, and just like dorsal flowing in, suddenly the presence of these proteins inside the nucleus begins some new chain reaction that eventually leads to some complex sets of genes being turned on that can easily be as complicated as this, where it could just as easily, had a few genes been switched slightly, a largely overlapping pattern with only 50 differences, similar type of cell, or a totally different type of cell, from bone to bone cancer to little kid. And the way this happens is not just this. This won't do it. The secret, because proteins are short-lived, is that you have to have this protein also come back and turn itself on. Now, it doesn't have to bind necessarily that simple. It can go back, and it can activate protein G, and protein G can activate A. It doesn't have to be a one-step thing, though it often is. So in the simplest sense, all you would need is gene A that can turn itself on. So once this protein comes in, it's going to bind to itself and make more of itself. That's going to sustain this memory. You want to be sure you don't inadvertently become B, because that may make you, you know, have hairs or gliosis or whatever else it is. And then you might want C. So you're turning on some set of proteins, turning off some others. But most importantly, you're maintaining the particular set of genes, or in this case, one gene that gives you your identity. Any questions about this? All right. So the answer now appears to be